It said we live in an information age, but every day there are fewer journalists and less original news reporting is being done. The Fourth Estate is obviously in trouble. 85% to 95% of news content originates with newspapers, and yet newsrooms are being gutted and shuttered across the country, and not always because they're losing money. The founders of FreePress.net, Robert McChesney, a professor at the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois, and journalist John Nichols, argue that the health of our democracy and a healthy press are linked, and they offer solutions to the current crisis in their book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, which is published by Nation Books. I'm very pleased that it brings them to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
Greetings.
The two of you wrote an article for the April 2009 Nation called The Death and Life of Great American Newspapers. What was the response?
Well, Leonard, this is John Nichols, and it was a pretty remarkable response. And that's, you know, I'm always cautious about saying we wrote a book because of the response, because then people think you just sort of like slapped it together. It's actually something we've been working on for a long time. But the truth of the matter is that when we wrote that cover story, we were already deep in the crisis. I have counseled hundreds of people to go into journalism and worked with a lot of students. Bob has actually taught people. And we were seeing so many of our people that we had encouraged to go into journalism literally losing their jobs, as well as major newspapers closing, and a crisis clearly taking form. And because we were so deeply in it, we assumed that a lot of other people were maybe thinking as hard about it as we were. What we found from the response to the article was that people were profoundly interested in it. They cared a lot about it, but they hadn't begun to wrap their head around it. The response suggested to us there was this immense interest, and it also suggested an opening that we thought was important. So many of the dialogues about media in this age they kind of fall into two camps. One is the old media fantasists. These are the people who think, well, it's just a rough time for newspapers and TV and radio, and someday down the line, advertising will come back and everything will be fine. And then the new media fabulists who say, oh, well, who cares if we lose newspapers, radio, television, because the internet's going to solve all our problems. What we understood and what we wanted to write about was a sort of a rational center, if you will, that said, look, there's a lot that old media does that is essential to a democratic state. It goes out and gathers information in a systematic way, and also in a way that hopefully at its best speaks truth to power. There's a lot that new media does in spreading information all around and getting it to lots of folks, but there's not a bridge being built. That lack of a bridge creates the potential for a huge void in our culture and our politics. And so we decided to write a book that explored that void and tried to propose some solutions for assuring that in the 21st century, we have a journalism that is civic and democratic, not merely commercial and entertainment-oriented.
Now, Robert, John just mentioned that some people say that the real culprit is the decline in advertising dollars. Is that the way you see it?
Well, I think that's one of the absolutely crucial factors, is the decline in ad dollars pretty much means that the era of commercially solvent news media, as we've known it for the last 100, 120 years, is ending. Last year, for the first time in its history, in one quarter, the New York Times had less revenues from advertising than it did from other sources. And every American newspaper throughout the 20th century received between 65 and 80% of its revenues from advertising. We're entering an era in which advertising is going to provide a much smaller percentage of the revenues, a much lower amount of revenues to cover news media, because online they've got a myriad of choices to reach their consumers. They no longer have to connect to journalism. And that means the important issue we face as Americans is that if journalism is no longer commercially solvent, if commercial interests seeking to maximize profit no longer will be in a position to hire lots of journalists to stock newsrooms around the country, competing newsrooms, what are we as a people going to do? What's our choices? What are our options? And that's why in the book, John and I lay out the argument that we ought to start by looking at what we did the first 100 years of American history, when we didn't have that much advertising, when it wasn't an especially lucrative area, yet we had the richest, most diverse, most democratic press system in the world. And what we did then, Leonard, is that we had extraordinarily large public subsidies, postal and printing subsidies, that created this treasure trove of print media throughout the 19th century.
But that was before the development of the Internet. I have friends who teach journalism, and they usually start off the first class by asking their students, how many of you read the New York Times today? And maybe a hand will go up. the pretty much everybody, if they do read newspapers, is reading them online. And they get a very different experience of the newspaper, don't they?
Well, they do. And one thing that we always, you know, kind of do our bona fides up front, look, I have written for newspapers since I was 11 years old. I have been a managing editor for newspapers and associated. I've done all the titles, all the gigs. I've hired people and run bureaus around the world, etc. And so I'm of the newspaper world, and yet I've been blogging since the mid to late 1990s, before the word blog was even in popular use. So both Bob and I have kind of worked this thing from both sides, and we understand that there is a transition going on, that an awfully lot of people get their news from other sources. There was just a study out yesterday that showed 27% of Americans now say that they get a substantial portion of their news from their telephone, i.e., you know, they've got these smartphones that are giving them, you know, bits of a news headline or something like that.
See, I thought it was friends calling them up and saying, did you hear what happened in Chile?
That's how it used to work a long time ago, right, Mr. Watson. But one of the things that we emphasize in this is that it doesn't really matter what the platform is, whether it is a radio show like this one, and happy 25th anniversary, Leonard.
Thank you.
Or a great radio show, a great television show, a great newspaper, a great website, a great blog. Wherever people get that information is less significant than how it's gathered and what the purpose of gathering it is. Our fear, Leonard, is that as there are fewer and fewer people who are paid to do journalism, who are sent out either to gather information and report it or to analyze information in a serious way, as fewer and fewer people do that, we run into a situation where there's a lot of information out there. It's aggregated in a lot of ways. It's churned up in a lot of ways. But there's not a lot of going out to gather it with the purpose of figuring out how citizens can use that information to govern their own affairs. We see a void opening up, and we fear that that void is going to be filled by public relations, by entertainment, by commercial pressures rather and entities, rather than by anything that even in the widest definition is journalistic. And we don't think this republic can survive and function without some source of original news gathering that happens on a regular basis with the purpose of informing citizens.
Not to pat ourselves on the back, because I think this is rather alarming, but a guest told me recently that NPR is now the only major American news organization that maintains a full-time operation in Baghdad.
Well, you know, our research demonstrates this over and over. Over the past 25 years, foreign bureaus, Washington bureaus, State House bureaus have just been cut to the bone. Virtually every major newsroom in the country today, if it hasn't been shut down, is just a fraction of what it was 10 or 20 years ago. One of the reasons NPR has blossomed is that basically the rest of commercial news is abandoned radio, leaving NPR the only game, only team in the league, and it's benefited by that. And we think that that's not an accident. We think that the public good nature of journalism is becoming more and more clear as commercial interests abandon the field, and that if we're going to have journalism, we're going to have to ramp up and improve and strengthen the resources going to institutions like NPR and PBS, to community media, and also to supercharge and make our local newsrooms, be they digital or newspapers or probably both, so that they're in a position that they can cover their communities in a way that they simply are not being covered in this country at all today. And like John said, you look at the recent elections where we're in a situation now where candidates running for major statewide offices are barely being covered in places like Illinois, which have famous newspapers like the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times. This is our future. Our future is a world in which candidates are largely uncovered, in which election days go past with little notice. It's not a future that really can be reconciled with our Constitution, with our First Amendment, with our understanding of how the system is supposed to work.
Well, it's not just newspapers. ABC announced a 25% cut in its news staff last week.
Mm-hmm. But Leonard, just to point out on that one, ABC is talking about closing down their Los Angeles bureau. How do you have a national news network that doesn't cover the second largest city, the second largest metro area in the country, and that kind of like skips the West Coast?
Oh, Well, how are they going to cover all of those movie star scandals?
Well, there you go. I mean, maybe there's a good argument for getting out of there, but I think they could they could still keep the Miami Bureau open and cover Tiger Woods.
But what about cable? Wasn't cable supposed to fill that vacuum?
You know, Leonard, I hate to admit this, but I've appeared on just about every cable news network there is, Fox, CNN, MSNBC, CNBC, and do some of them pretty regularly. And I'm always honored when I'm asked, right? But I'm never asked to go on those shows as a journalist. I'm asked to talk about some great article I've done. I'm asked to go on as a talking head who's going to take one side in an argument. Often, it can even be an argument I haven't written about. And this is true of everybody that appears on these cable shows. Most of the cable, quote-unquote, news shows that we talk about, that we focus so much attention on, have no journalists employed by the show. And, in fact, really only have bookers to bring, political pundits or some journalists on to argue about issues, but not to advance any story or to investigate anything.
Now, we had a Great Depression. Advertising dollars pretty much dried up. What happened to the newspapers? Didn't they thrive nonetheless?
Well, they did much better then. That's right. And that was a whole different era. That was an era in which the newspapers suffered, but the advertising came back because it had nowhere else to go. And that was the only game in town. And most American communities in the 1930s, unless they were the very largest cities like New York, only had one or two newspapers. A significant percentage just had one. And they pretty much were safe markets then, if you're a monopoly or a duopoly. And so the papers all survived. They did well. We're in a very different era now. We're in an era in which advertising, which never had anything more than an opportunistic relationship with journalism and news, now has a lot of other options to reach their target audiences online, and they have no connection to journalism, and so they're not supporting it. And, you know, another point to keep in mind about the problems of our commercial journalism system right now is that to the extent our bloggers online are trying desperately to get advertising support so they can eat if they want to somehow survive, the traditional power that old-fashioned media had, where there was only one newspaper in town or three TV stations, that gave them a lot of leverage over major advertisers, that the advertisers couldn't interfere with their editorial product. Now when you've got 1,000 websites all desperate to eat, and you've got one or two major advertisers or a handful, the power shifted to them. And so we should really be concerned about relying too much in advertising in this environment, because it could take us back to the bad old days of 100 years ago before professional journalism, when most Americans had real trouble taking any of the news they read in their paper seriously because they feared it was corrupted by advertising influence.
Well, now is it being corrupted by conglomeratization? Should we be concerned about Comcast's proposed purchase of NBC Universal from General Electric?
In a word, yes, absolutely. In fact, consolidation and conglomeration of newspaper, broadcast, cable, and digital ownership is something that Bob and I have been writing about for the better part of 15 years. The interesting thing is that for a long time, our concern was not that we were losing journalism per se, but that it was becoming too homogenized. We were getting a one-size-fits-all journalism at the national level and at the local level around the country. This new book really takes the concerns a step further, recognizing that in a period of rapid consolidation, what many of these companies have done is take on huge amounts of debt in order to monopolize either a community, even in some cases there's newspaper chains that are trying to be the dominant player in whole states, and here with a Comcast-NBC merger or something at the national level, where they're taking on so much debt to do this that the way they pay their debt, the way they keep their investors happy, is to cut more journalism. And so we end up in this terrible kind of death spiral where we have homogenization, a one-size-fits-all approach, and we have very little journalism within what remains. It really is a nightmare scenario. And one of the things that we say, as serious observers of this crisis, a crisis that's seen 140 newspapers closed last year, that's seeing more than 1,000 newspaper employees laid off every month for the last 2 years. As we look at this crisis, the real collapse of journalism in this country, we say to ourselves that this is the sort of moment that George Orwell would have slapped his head and said, hold it, you know, when I wrote 1984, I kind of blew it. I thought the big scary thing in the future was that Big Brother would be watching you. As it turns out, my great fear is that you will be watching Big Brother 24/7, round the clock, television stations and other media outlets that suggest to you that they're giving you, you know, some sort of palette of news, but are really giving you very, very little journalism and a lot of sort of manufactured, packaged information that is meant to entertain you, meant to get you to buy things, but is not meant to encourage you to engage in civic life or to be a citizen or, heaven forbid, to vote in elections.
I was amused seeing a film about the current situation in Russia. One of the scenes, this is a documentary, an upper middle class woman asks her husband to turn off the TV show he's watching, which is about the people debating over whether the West has it in for Russia, trying to do Russia in. And she said, they all say the same thing. They say that things were lousy in the 90s and now they're great under Putin. And I laughed because I thought, how is that all different from what I see on so many of these cable talk shows?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, it is. Our journalism has really devolved to the point where much of the content of our commercial television news, for example, is probably compatible with a fairly undemocratic society. There are scandals about celebrities, stuff about natural disasters, sort of just uncritically invoking what people in power say and keeping the range of debate between people who are official sources. I mean, this is the stuff that you could have had in the old Soviet Union comfortably. And, you know, we don't say we have that sort of press system here. We still have extraordinarily important freedoms. But I think that devolution, what you're talking about, is very much in place. One of the things we did, Leonard, for this book is we wanted to see what the relationship was of public relations people to working journalists in the United States. It's sort of, you know, PR people are there basically. They work for corporations and government, and their job is to get stories in the news but not have the reader know that it's actually been planted by PR. They think it's a legitimate news story, so they take it seriously. They let their guard down, so to speak. And so the relationship between the number of PR people and journalists is critical for understanding the propaganda quotient in our news media. And in 1960, the relationship was basically one-to-one, one PR person to one journalist. By 1980, it was more or less the same. It was 1.2 PR people to every working journalist. Today, the ratio is 4 PR people to every working journalist. And if we continue at the current rates of growth of PR and collapse in working journalists, the ratio will probably be 6-1 or 7-1 in 2 or 3 years.
My guests are Robert W. McChesney, and it's really hard to say this, the Gutgesell.
The second G is silent.
The Gutgesell Endowed Professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He is also the host of the radio show Media Matters. And John Nichols, who is the Dacian's Washington correspondent and the associate editor of the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin. They have collaborated on a book called The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again. It's published by Nation Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Robert W. McChesney and John Nichols. The book they've collaborated on, The Death and Life of American Journalism, The Media Revolution That Will Begin the World Again, published by Nation Books. You mentioned earlier that early in our history, government supported the press. Was it really a government subsidy of the press?
You betcha, Leonard. In fact, it's one of the most fascinating parts of the research that we've done. And we always mention that our research is really based on the groundbreaking work of a lot of historians of a relatively undiscussed critical part of our media, which is the Postal Service. And at the founding of the American experiment, the people who had just revolted against Great Britain understood very well that the greatest danger that they faced was a concentration of information. If information wasn't widely distributed, if it wasn't available throughout what was at that time a rather broad, rather large country, then the citizens wouldn't be able at any level to govern themselves or to be involved in the great civic debates that were essential to forming a nation. And so they created massive postal subsidies. They essentially said, look, if you want to publish a newspaper, then go right ahead and, you know, we're going to help you to distribute it at essentially the lowest possible rate. And in fact, there were even debates about having no cost at all. James Madison said if you had any postal charge whatsoever for distributing a newspaper, that would undermine the ability of the most essential voices, those of true dissenters, those who challenged the assumptions of this new country from being distributed. So they understood very, very well why they were doing these subsidies. They also created a great many printing subsidies. In fact, many of the great newspapers in the first 100 years of the country were formed via this combination of postal and printing subsidies. And the really important thing to understand is that this didn't just sustain newspapers that were friendly to a sitting government or even to the major parties at the early stages of the American experiment. The great advocates for expanding the postal subsidy were the editors of abolitionist newspapers. And the abolitionist cause was not allowed to be debated in Congress for the first 70 years of the Republic. The original sin of the American experiment, human bondage, was not permitted really to be an issue in our presidential campaigns for the first many decades. And so it was the abolitionist press that really put this great dissent onto the table and forced it into our discourse. And it's very significant that when the subsidy was dramatically expanded in a manner that the abolitionist editors had demanded, so that they really could distribute their newspapers essentially free of charge in their home regions, that's the point at which the abolitionist cause began to take off politically in the United States and again, to force a dialogue that otherwise wouldn't have existed. So far from being, you know, some sort of government overlay that forces a narrow discourse, there's an awfully lot of evidence from American history that suggests it was government subsidies that opened up the discourse and really allowed America to address some of its most critical issues.
But the press was far from exemplary in the early days of the Republic. It was a lot more partisan than Fox News and MSNBC are today.
Absolutely. And Jefferson has the famous quote that a person who read nothing at all would be better informed than a person who read just newspapers. He was very critical of the newspapers of his time. But the important thing about Jefferson and Madison and all the founders is they also were principled people who understood you had to have those newspapers. You had to have the ability for people to communicate with each other in order for the Republic to work. And that's why they always were the strongest advocates of massive subsidies. And to give some sense of how significant these subsidies were, Leonard, we computed using postal records and printing records of the U.S. government in the 1840s what the percentage of the U.S. GDP was that was government, national government, federal government subsidies of journalism in the 1840s, and then took that same percentage and applied to the current GDP today to understand what we'd have to pay at the federal level to have a similar type subsidy. And the number we came up with is the federal government today would have to pay roughly $30 billion to subsidize journalism to the same extent the U.S. government did in the 1840s. This is a huge investment.
When I first started working at WNYC, the station was largely subsidized by the city, and little by little that changed. But in those days, when the city owned our license, we would often get pressure to put people on. In fact, not just pressure. I'd be told, you have to put the controller on your show next Thursday. It didn't matter who I'd already booked. One of the arguments against government involvement is that government tries to control.
Yep, absolutely. It's a totally legitimate argument. It's one that Bob and I passionately embrace. I'll tell you this, as somebody who's been working for newspapers and in journalism, in the private side of it, I haven't been as good as you, Leonard. I didn't get a public radio program. But somebody who's been working...
you wanted to make a living.
Yeah, that's right. But it still hasn't worked out. But doing this since I was a kid, if I thought there was the slightest chance that I was arguing for a structure or a system that would allow the government in any way to tell me what to do or to tell other journalists what to do, I'd be leading the charge against it. But what I know is this. When we look at examples from our own history, the good examples and then we also look at the bad examples to guard against them. But also when we look at examples from around the world, from other countries that have highly subsidized journalism, not the Pol Pot's Cambodia or, you know, Stalin's Pravda, but from countries that we might reasonably compare ourselves to, like Sweden or Norway or Germany or France, what we find is that a subsidized press can be structured in a way that it actually creates more dissent, that it is more challenging of government than our own media system today in the United States. So I don't think that we reject a solution simply because there have been abuses in the past. What we do is guard against those abuses and assure that we can develop a system that is transparent, that is functional, and that sustains democracy. That's really what this is all about, Leonard. It's saying that in the 21st century, we're going to have to come up with new ways to make sure that there are the resources to do journalism. And we shouldn't reject any approach. That doesn't mean we reject commercial approaches, but we also should not reject publicly supported or publicly encouraged approaches.
You say that it's unfair to millions of Americans for journalism to abandon old media like newspapers and television for the internet. So you're proposing that the government somehow pay subsidies or pay corporations to relinquish their media holdings?
Well, let's be real clear. We are not making an argument that is technology-based. We're not saying we're in favor of old media versus new media or new media versus old media. We're in favor of newsrooms, competing independent newsrooms that gather the news in competition with other newsrooms. And we think that ultimately the technology that they will be delivered by will be almost exclusively digital, but that's a decade or two. That's a long ways away. We still have a significant part of the country that's going to be getting their news and information from what's called old media, be it television, radio, or print. And so we're in the process of making that transition. So our point isn't about picking a technology and defending it. It's about trying to get the resources so we have credible independent newsrooms. And that's really where our entire focus is. And in doing that, we're very clear that we're not fans of subsidizing the companies that have run journalism into the ground. We think they're trying to get out of the industry, and we want to bid them farewell and say, thanks, guys. Glad you had a nice run here. See you later. We don't think it's a proper use of public funds to bankroll commercial interests that have no interest in journalism or have demonstrated very little. The monies we're mostly interested in subsidizing would be subsidies that would go to nonprofit and non-commercial media. But we think there's got to be a public debate about the best possible subsidies, how best to do it. And once we start that debate and start studying it and put it right out there on the table, we're convinced that we can come up with solutions, because our own history and the evidence, again, we compile from almost every other major democratic nation in the world demonstrates it's a solvable problem. But it's only solvable as soon as we recognize it as a problem to address.
Have any contemporary newspapers made the adjustment?
Sure. Now, we're not going to suggest that there have been a sufficient number, but there are examples. In fact, one of the ones that we cite and write a great deal about in the book is the St. Petersburg Times down in St. Petersburg, Florida. And when its longtime owner was aging, he didn't want that newspaper to go into the kind of churn that so many newspapers have been in recent decades, and that is bought by one chain, then bought by another, then sold to a investment house, and, you know, kind of moving around every time somebody taking a piece of it. He wanted it to stay locally controlled and with a journalistic purpose. And so he set up essentially a foundation setting, a school setting that would guide it. And the fascinating thing about the St. Petersburg Times is it hasn't been completely free of the challenges of this era. There's no question it's been hit by the decline in advertising and all the other struggles. But there's also no question that it's been able to maintain a much more substantial staff than most daily newspapers of its size. And here's the really notable thing. And again, it's not the only measure. But in recent years, the St. Petersburg Times has begun to regularly win the Pulitzer Prize, something it didn't used to do. And so one of the things that we're suggesting is that I'm not sure the St. Petersburg Times got dramatically better, but what I will tell you is that as most of other media declines, this newspaper that's been somewhat protected from the worst of this commercial collapse has been able to maintain enough quality to be recognized by its own industry as outstanding.
What about some of the other approaches? Senator Ben Cardin, Democrat from Maryland, proposed the Newspaper Revitalization Act. Then there's this a business model that's been proposed, the Low-Profit Limited Liability Corporation, or L3C. Do either of those look promising?
Well, yeah. In fact, as you know, we write about them both at length in Chapter 4 of our book.
That's why I brought them up.
I know. That's why.
You for that.
Thank you very much, Leonard, for alluding to them. We talk about all a variety of different options down the road. And I think the important thing it's fundamentally important that you start with is we have to understand that journalism is a public good. It's no longer going to be provided exclusively by commercial interests trying to maximize profit. There simply isn't enough money there. And we're all in favor of commercial interests doing journalism. Anyone wants to start it, nothing we would do would stop them. We encourage them. But we think even if all the commercial schemes pan out, We're only going to get to the 10-yard line, the wrong 10-yard line. We're going to need an immense amount of support, or huge elements of our government and our country will not be covered at all. And so we come up with a variety of proposals inside the fourth chapter that try to get at that, like the idea of converting daily newspapers into nonprofit institutions or foundations run institutions, or having them, like you said, as low profit. It's a legal category that allows some of the privileges and benefits of being of a profit run company with some of the obligations and benefits of being a nonprofit.
Do you think Rupert Murdoch or the New York Times Corporation are likely to look upon that as something that they'd want to do?
Do you know, Leonard, this is what we say. If Rupert Murdoch and the New York Times want to keep on going, there's nothing that we propose that would undermine their ability to do that. In fact, we think that there's many things that we're proposing that will increase their ability to do a good job. So we've got no fight with them. But what we are saying is that in communities across this country, particularly low-income communities and rural areas that are already underserved journalistically, where there are newspaper companies proposing to close down a daily newspaper or to gut it out to such an extent that it cannot begin to serve the basic needs of the people in its community, that there ought to be structures available to convert that newspaper into a locally owned, low-profit or cooperatively run publication, and maybe but to go online.
Unfortunately, my great thanks to Robert W. McChesney and John Nichols. Their book, The Death and Life of American Journalism, from Nation Books. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you very much.